Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. After a short break to wrap up graduate school, I'm back with today's interview with Steve Whitman, a permaculture designer and planner from New Hampshire. In addition to all of his work on various planning boards, he also runs Resilience Planning and Design, LLC. During our conversation today, Steve and I talk about engaging in government and community planning in order to inject more permaculture into the process. This is the beginning of an examination of how to make our work as designers a part of the mainstream discussion by including a holistic approach into city and community development, to change the laws, codes, and ordinances in ways that allow us to have a more active role in what happens where we live. As the population of the world continues to grow and more people live in towns and cities, we can bring permaculture to the forefront in those environments and get involved at all levels, be that local, state, or national. Government and planning are some really big picture issues, and I know that they can be intimidating. Bringing up these kinds of questions at a permaculture design course brought shudders throughout the class. But I think that speaking with Steve, we kept things very straightforward. There's plenty of discussion about how planning works, the various ways we can become part of the decision-making process, and how to bring about change. But this isn't a technical conversation. It's not full of jargon, but honestly, is probably the most approachable conversation we could have had on this complicated subject. I enjoyed talking to Steve, and between the two of us, we broke things down into something you can get started using today just by picking up the phone and making a few calls. Listen to this interview with Steve, get some ideas, and I'll join you afterwards with some more thoughts on where and who to start with. At the very end, I also include an update on my personal path for those of you who have asked for one. Then, Steve, if you're ready, can you give us a bit of your biography and background, how you came to practice permaculture? And then we'll move into this conversation about providing assistance to communities and municipalities.
So, my name is Steve Whitman. I live in Plymouth, New Hampshire. And I came to permaculture two ways. Initially as a homeowner on our first property that we owned, my wife and I, and then also professionally as a planner working in the state of New Hampshire, smart growth issues and other development issues. And what attracted me to permaculture was the fact that I can work at different scales and use the benefits of permaculture as a design framework. And so I actually started to use it on our own property, as many folks that listen to the podcast probably did. And so just experimenting and implementing on our own land and collecting feedback and making changes and starting to develop systems with more complexity over time. And then through my own certification course at Crystal Waters in Australia with Max Lindiger, and then through my teacher training at Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, continued to see the applications at the municipal level. I'm really excited to talk with you today, Scott, about the possibility, the great possibilities for local communities and for permaculture folks to get involved in their own community in that system that may seem a little overwhelming to them.
Well, it's a conversation that I've had because I sit on the Parks and Rec board for my local township. And I know in having some conversations with permaculture students, the idea of engaging at the governmental level is really intimidating at the very beginning. To get involved in that process, to get on the appropriate boards, or in some cases even to run for office, and then to begin to apply these ideas, it's a very different world from what I think many of us are taught in our permaculture design course. And it's something, you know, I'm very interested in hearing more about because my focus has been so limited. One question I do have about your background in planning, were you working as a professional planner then within government?
Yes. So I went to graduate school for regional planning and environmental planning at University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Mass. And came to New Hampshire to work as a professional planner. Worked at the local level for a regional planning agency and then for the state office before going into private practice 12 years ago. So I've worked in all the sectors.
So if you could give us then a bit of an idea of how you blended that experience with permaculture to give us an idea of how then for people coming from the other side, they might use permaculture to engage in their community and municipality.
Sure. I think one of the important distinctions for today's talk is that so much of what we do in permaculture is voluntary, that we're choosing to set good examples on our own properties or on projects we're involved with. And the reality of so much of the land use change in our communities is that it's regulatory. And so many of the land use changes that we see happen in our towns and cities are happening under regulations that have been adopted in that place, being guided by those regulations. And so I see the potential for permaculturists to get involved in that regulatory process, to get involved in both the creation of the comprehensive plan that guides zoning and site plan and subdivision regulations, but also in the development of those regulations. And I can get more into the details of why I think that's important, but so much of our community's change over time is dictated by that process and those regulations. And in most communities that I've had the benefit of working with, it is very different from the ethics and principles of permaculture.
I think about just, you know, one of the examples that I go back to repeatedly in the conversation about my own work here has been about something as simple as changing the regulations for small-scale livestock, because for a long time you had to have 3 acres to have even something as simple as a rabbit hutch or chickens. And then the regulations were changed. If you had an acre or more, you could have small-scale livestock. But then when you actually read through those regulations, those rules are so restrictive that you would wind up having to have like a perfectly square acre with no buildings on it, no road frontage, no water features, and then you would only have an 8x8 square in the very center of that property for those chickens. And how, you know, very often it's easy to get that process of regulation change started, but that you really need to be involved in it if it's something that you're an expert on or familiar with, to stay active in that process throughout in order to make sure that you get something that's functional on the other side of it.
I would totally agree. We see so many examples just like the one you cited. And I think even if people are unsure of the process at the local level, showing up to a meeting makes a world of difference. I go to a lot of towns to work with planning boards and conservation commissions and other local officials, and if there's not someone in the room asking the question, it often doesn't get addressed. And if there's not somebody there with any expertise in, you know, raising small animals or agricultural practices on small lots or natural building or whatever might be out there as something that we can engage in and encourage, it doesn't get addressed. So even if someone doesn't want to sit on a board yet, just attending the meetings, listening to the conversation, asking questions is very helpful.
So then that would be the first place for many people to start. Just educate themselves about the issues and show up to some meetings. Even if they don't have something to say, listen and understand more about that process.
Absolutely. So what I've been trying to do professionally is work with communities that want to make positive changes or guide land use in a more positive direction. I mean, the buzzword is resilience, just because of so much of it. So much of that word and its definitions encompass what we believe in permaculture and what we try to create in our systems, you know, real dynamic ecosystems. So I think that as we try to do that in communities, having people come out to participate in the conversation, not needing to come with all the answers, but being willing to participate and understand how the process works, we're going to see innovations in communities that we've never seen before. I have started professionally to try to raise this question both in planning circles and in permaculture circles, because I think there are a lot of other folks who could contribute to the conversation. And I think all of us together could create a much bigger change on the landscape for the better. And I can explain a little bit more how I see the system now. And it's pretty amazing that so much is in place that could actually assist us with positive transformation.
Well, if you'd like to go ahead and walk us through that, I'd like to certainly hear more.
Sure. So I think a couple of the things that are important to note when you look at how communities in regions plan for the future is that they look at two different scales. They look at the landscape scale. So how is our town situated? What are our resources, both natural and economic and human and otherwise? So they're looking at that landscape scale for their area, whether it be the community itself or the region. And then they're also looking at site level land use change and decision making. So often the comprehensive plan or the regional plan, depending on where you're located, will address the landscape scale. And they'll talk about the types of uses of land that should happen in different areas. And it'll talk about how to guide change over time and things like that. Then where this actually happens is within the land use regulations. So if you or I want to come in and, you know, raise small livestock or develop a piece of property, we have to follow a regulatory process in that municipality. Unfortunately, there's usually a disconnect where the plan talks about a utopian vision of the future, and it might say a lot of things we'd like to see from a permaculture perspective about preserving natural resources and, you know, being more sustainable, reducing energy use as a municipality, things like that. There's often a disconnect between that vision and the land use regulations. So I often will go to a community and read their master plan and get pretty excited how they want to, you know, focus future development in their downtown or village and preserve natural resources and promote agriculture. And then I read their land use regulations, and what they've allowed is 1-acre lots across the entire community, a mix of uses across the entire community, and they are surprised when they get a pattern sprawl. So part of it is addressing this disconnect, pointing out when the vision is one thing and the regulations are another. But the other bigger part that I think we all can contribute to is helping create a regulatory process that guides change towards both restoration and preservation of ecological function. Right now, most of the process for site plan and subdivision requires and assumes a certain level of ecological dismantling or destruction, that a site will not be as good after development as it was before.
Thinking about just some of the little bits of government and governance that I've been involved in, and from kind of that middle ground of involvement, changing that regulatory process sounds really big. I think that's putting it mildly, but I don't want to come at it from a perspective that approaches it too negatively. So I was wondering if you could walk us through how you imagine bringing about that kind of change to make it move in a more positive direction.
Sure. And I think it's actually, it does seem really big. What we often see in communities is people will take on a cause. They'll take on one issue. Stormwater is a very popular one, both because, you know, federal and state regulations are becoming more restrictive, and so towns are having to evolve their regulations. But also that's often where there may be some public interest. So let's just take stormwater as an example. You know, you realize that future development happening in your community could be happening with a much more comprehensive way of dealing with stormwater, a much more innovative or ecological way. And so one of the packages of tools are these low-impact development regulations for stormwater. And so somebody has to bring that to the attention of the community. Sometimes it's a local official or staff member. You know, the planner goes to a conference, learns about it, sees it happening in another community, brings it to the board's attention, or it could be a local citizen. So that happens. There's a discussion. There's some level of education that has to happen at the board and then resident level before things are adopted. And depending on whether you're in a town or within a city, there's a different process for how regulations are adopted. But that type of scenario happens all the time in communities, you know, across North America and other places as well. What we're missing, because we can do these one-off things, we can take on, you know, small livestock, or we can take on stormwater, we can take on renewable energy systems. What we're missing are towns having a comprehensive way of looking at it, looking at properties and knowing that they should be dealing both with stormwater and with landscaping and with energy systems. You know, the comprehensive framework that we look at in permaculture design is lacking. So I know the first step can be a challenge for some, and that's where we need to start. But what I'm encouraging permaculture folks to do is to bring that whole system approach, that holistic approach to their local regulatory process.
So then to become initially kind of advocates for some of these one-off programs, to become a part of the governance process, and then through that begin to educate the people who are involved in government about what the other options are in order to bring in, hey, if you're going to be working with stormwater, let's look at landscaping. If we're going to be looking at landscaping, we might be able to use that to assist with these other espoused values that are coming from the comprehensive plan and integrate the plan and the regulations so that they're more in line with one another.
You get it, Scott. Yes. And I think just, it doesn't have to be seen as confrontational. I think what permaculture, people with a permaculture perspective engaged in their local regulatory process can see a lot of efficiencies. And so I think when we get engaged in a process and we can point out how we can help a future developer. A lot of the times I'm thinking about non-residential uses, so commercial uses, industrial uses, but how we can help them better site their building and how we can tell them ahead of time this is going to be expected, that they can better site their building and that they can integrate the things we want to see on the property. So if there's going to be parking and there's going to be stormwater facilities and there's going to be landscaping, most regulations require that each of those is independent and separate from the other. And I think in permaculture, we know that that's not necessarily the best way forward, that to integrate and to create an ecosystem approach can be much more efficient, can have a smaller footprint and leave, you know, a larger balance of the land undeveloped, where it can probably function best the way it has evolved over time. So it could mean that there's a smaller footprint, that there's less cost in some cases, and that maintenance, although there may be some maintenance as there is with kind of the standard landscapes we see and parking lots we see today, the maintenance is going to be very different. And I think we all know of some landscapers out there who are starting to figure that out and be able to pitch that to property owners.
One of the pieces that comes with that is in engaging at that regulatory and municipal level. At least in the United States, we are in a country that is very credential oriented. And right now, the permaculture design certificate is known within certain circles, but not others. Do you feel that that certificate alone can carry enough weight for an individual who wants to engage developers? Or is there additional certifications or education that would be, if you will, ideal for convincing people that you're an expert and you know what you're doing?
That's a really good question. I have thought about that a little bit. I think that the permaculture design certificate and the person can engage locally with decision makers. Like, I think if I were to approach a local land use board in my community and they know who I am, or I take the time to let them know who I am and, you know, what I love about my community and how I want to offer some help, or I just participate and they can see it for themselves, there's a certain amount of social capital that's probably more important than the actual certificate. And kind of the proof is in seeing how I participate. But I also think that we need to engage, and this has been an area that I've worked as a permaculture instructor, to engage with landscape architects, engineers, planners, those folks that have a certificate or a stamp that is recognized by the development community and that they're going to hire already, to give them permaculture background and a permaculture perspective. Because they often already have some other skills we're very interested in seeing used. You know, whether they be technical skills like CAD or just, you know, more advanced design skills. We almost have to attack it from both angles, and hopefully over time it starts to raise an awareness of this permaculture education process and its benefits. I'm not sure if I answered your question the way I intended, but
what you get at in that answer, though, is that there are other ways around this credential issue or even the language of permaculture. It is a phrase in some circles, at least that I've encountered, that it has some baggage that comes with it. But if you're someone who's active and engaged in a part of the process, then those problems can go away. Something as simple as knowing who the engineering firm is that your municipality deals with, if they don't have somebody on staff, but rather has a firm or something, that they could engage with the people at that firm who are doing the planning for your township or the community you live in, and then begin to talk with them about what choices are they making, why are they making them, and try to insert some of this more holistic design mentality into what they're doing. And then over time, use that goodwill that we build to help influence more projects.
Absolutely. I'm glad we're doing this as a team, Scott.
It's just such a big question. The governance process is so obfuscated if you're not a part of it. And all, you know, people who run for office and all these other things, that until you're integrated into it, you just don't know. And I became a member of the Parks and Rec Board just because there was an Adner Township newsletter saying that they were looking for citizens who could serve on the board. And then there was an application process and an interview process, and then finally sitting on the board with my background and, you know, influencing policy so that we're not out there poisoning vultures or having them trapped and moved because people feel that they're unsightly. Having conversations about ecosystem services.
It's a slow process.
Very much so. And I know in the private sector, you know, you can make a decision and start digging the next day with a couple of phone calls. But in government or any kind of a large bureaucracy, what might take you a couple of days can take weeks or months of meetings and planning. And, you know, you'll have 5 minutes at a board conference to say your piece, and then there, you know, it'll take another month or two before it's voted on. Then you might be asked back to speak some more on a topic. And it's so, so different from being a private citizen working on your own land.
It is. I sit both as a planning board member on my local planning board, and then I attend planning board meetings to help communities. And often when I'm sitting on the board, I get a real education into, you know, these are lay people. These are people who are volunteering their time. Maybe they have some guidance from the town staff, and the town staff don't necessarily have some of the skill set that we would like to see from a permaculture perspective. So there are a lot of things that come up that just aren't understood by people. Ecosystems are definitely a topic that's not understood by a lot of folks. And what we often see with communities is we will read their plan and we see the vision that they've put forward, and then we read the regulations and it's leading them in a different direction. It's often leading them to a more disjointed, destructive, sprawl pattern of development that they didn't originally want and often aren't pleased with as they see applications come in and speak to it. So the disconnect is not clear often at the local level. And just by pointing it out and addressing it, we can often see huge changes for the positive in how we can recraft regulatory language and guide development differently. So that's part of the point I was trying to make.
So then one place to start then would be to read through not only what the land use plan would be, but also to familiarize oneself with the local regulations?
Absolutely. We call it a regulatory audit or a policy audit. There aren't that many people doing it. We've been doing it for communities, a lot of communities in New Hampshire, and some other folks have started to do the same. It's kind of a boring exercise. I think that's why a lot of people don't do it. But I can learn a tremendous amount about a community by just simply doing, as you said, reading the plan, noting the big policy statements, and then looking in the regulations for laws that reinforce that, or identifying when they're completely opposed. So it is an exercise that most people can do if they're willing to take the time and sit down and kind of comb through those documents in that kind of linear fashion. But it's important because so much of the land use change we see in communities is guided by those regulations. And if the regulations are guiding us in a more destructive way, if they're reducing resilience, if they're not addressing adaptation and other things that are important to our communities, we're not going to achieve that vision of resilience. You know, we're basically regulating that we won't. And I think that's important in a place that permaculturalists could bring their skill set to the work that needs to be done.
Look through those regulations, find those ones that support the land use plan, and then look for those ones that lead towards a greater disconnect and more destruction, and begin having conversations about which ones to promote and which ones to change.
Absolutely. So like if I had a comprehensive plan for a community and I read through and there's a section on local agriculture, and there may be information that's relevant at the time. Like if a plan was written this year, it would probably address, you know, drought conditions in parts of the country, questions about food supply, things that that community may be concerned about. And it might point to its own food insecurity. Well, then if I look at the land use regulations and I see it's virtually impossible to set up any kind of land use that's related to commercial agriculture because it's just too onerous, it's not agriculture friendly, then I would point that out as a disconnect. You know, here we are addressing our own food security and saying we have a commitment to solutions in our own region, and then we're making it virtually impossible for somebody to go out and address the issue. So that's just one example, and we could probably find them in all sectors. And can you imagine if somebody wanted to do multiple things on one property? That usually creates some level of heartache with the regulations.
Think also of things like weed ordinances in various towns that keep drought-tolerant plantings from existing. Mentioning the drought that's occurring now, that, you know, there are certain plants in various communities that are on approved lists and others are not. And if you have something along the sidewalk that doesn't meet that, you can get fined for it.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of these regulations, whether it's that or your example about small livestock, often something was written to address a problem, and it has broader implications years later. So we find these things in land use regulations, like what is this language? It does not make sense. And often there's some history behind, you know, it was adopted because there was a problem with a particular landowner, or they saw it in regulations from another town and thought it was a good idea, so they adopted it. But so this process of revisiting the land use regulations and changing them happens very frequently in some communities. Often the ones that are the most engaged in positive change. We'll constantly be revisiting and evaluating, you know, collecting feedback as we do in a permaculture system.
But depending on where you are, there may not have been one of these reviews for decades.
Absolutely.
I have a copy of my township's regulations sitting here. Now this book begins to make a lot more sense through this lens of the way that regulations can change over time or why they originate in a certain manner.
Absolutely. I'm finding this topic, which I'm glad we're able to explore today, I'm finding this topic of, you know, local engagement, local decision-making, a permaculture perspective to, you know, designing landscapes, ecosystems, structures, how this all comes together and how we can use the existing framework and decision-making and our holistic systems-oriented knowledge to actually work towards those visions in our communities. I think we have all the pieces. I think we have all of the solutions. We have all the right people. We just need to get them in the right place. And if a meeting seems to be boring or confrontational, it doesn't attract a lot of attention. I have an example from New Hampshire here where I went to a master plan meeting. So a comprehensive plan for the community. The town was asking for input. How do you want to see our community change in the future? There were four of us in the room. We had a few minutes that we could provide some feedback and some ideas, but they had a lot on their agenda. And so there was a limited amount of creativity that night, and only four people's, you know, shared perspective coming before the planning board. The same week, I went to a transition town meeting, and we had 60 people voluntarily show up, use the open space format, and come up with a tremendous list of positive, non-regulatory, and even regulatory ideas for how to move the town forward in a more resilient way. They laughed, they had food. So there's two different systems operating in the same area, but not, you know, not cooperating with each other.
I wonder how different it would have been if those 60 people from the transition meeting had shown up to that board meeting.
I think it could have been wonderful if our towns can be creative with their process to make it more engaging. You know, there's a lot we can learn from transition about how to let people guide a meeting. And our regulatory boards and agencies, you know, use a lot more of a formal process, but they can have, you know, a work session that is more like a transition town meeting, or they can have a design charrette. We design charrettes with communities all the time that are much more engaging, where a resident can sit down with an architect and talk about, you know, what if we were to move our buildings closer to the road and make things more pedestrian oriented and add more vegetation for treating stormwater, and they can sketch things out together and then figure out how to code the regulations for it. So I think we have all the models we need. We just need to use them effectively.
It sounds then like the first place to start with that is to begin by engaging government.
I would agree. And what I'm trying to do as a permaculture person in the permaculture community is to also engage with my fellow professional planners, engineers, landscape architects, to get them to understand, you know, what we bring to the table, why it's valuable, and that there are communities of people who have taken their own time and money to educate themselves and learn how systems work on their own properties. And they're out there in our towns and cities, and we need to engage them and help them understand how the process works and help them help us create new solutions. It's just trying to unite these two groups, both professional and inspired permaculture folks.
You make me think of a trip that I took last year to Virginia to explore permaculture south of the Mason-Dixon line, because there's a continually growing movement of permaculture in the Northeast. There's a lot on the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington State, you know, across the northern tier down in Texas. But a lot of people who I talked to, we don't know a lot about permaculture from like Virginia to Georgia. But the more that I talk with folks and get contact from people in the audience, very often we have permaculture practitioners who are just a town or two apart who don't know that they're there.
Right.
And not only, you know, engaging on a professional level and connecting as permaculture practitioners, but continuing to figure out where the rest of our community is so that we can come together as kind of an organized front to present these ideas, to show that there's a diversity of creativity within this system, within the education that people have received, within where their particular specialty, but that there are a lot of people out there who are interested in these issues of resilience, to borrow that buzzword, that just don't have a voice yet.
Absolutely. And I think there are lots of ways we do that. I'm glad, you know, you're sharing that story, because I think it's important. We took one tool as an example from New York State where they're doing basically like a half permaculture course for municipal officials and local leaders. So it's shorter than a full PDC, but it gives them an introduction to these concepts. And then they can take that back to their job in their community or their position on a local board, you know, whether it be a park and rec board or a zoning board or anything. So they've done that in the Finger Lakes region of New York, and it was intriguing to us. We brought it to New Hampshire and have run it. And it's interesting to see who self-selects to participate in a course like that, you know, from cities and from towns, folks that are very much engaged in government work and folks that are interested in how the process works. But the relationships between those people, you know, as you're saying, is really important. And we've seen people bring things back to their departments and create new ways forward. We've seen people, one young woman, I think she was 21 or 22 at the time, ran to be a local select person in her community. And so she's engaging in conversations about how do you deal with something that's considered an invasive along the roadside that the town used to just spray. How do you deal with it from a permaculture perspective? And are our regulations helping people be more resilient? And do we have better solutions for dealing with solid waste in our community? So it's very cool to see these people get connected and get elevated to positions where they can ask these questions as well.
And what was the name of that course that came out of New York? And you say that's from the Finger Lakes. Is that with Steve Gabriel and Michael Burns and all them?
It is, yes. Community Training in Ecological Design, offered through Finger Lakes Permaculture. And they were nice enough to share their materials with us, and we kind of used it as a model for what we could do. But I think a course like that could be offered in every state. And it's great, too, because it provides an opportunity for folks that might not otherwise become engaged in a permaculture course to kind of learn a little bit more about it. And we've seen quite a few people then want to go on to either continue their own self-study, you know, listen to the podcast and reading stuff online, or maybe eventually taking a permaculture design course.
I'll have to follow up with the folks at Flipsy to learn out more about this. I remember they announced it when I was up there last year, and this sounds like a really useful way to begin engaging locally in a way that's more comprehensive than an introduction to permaculture course, but without having to go all the way for the design certificate.
Absolutely. I'm also working on a doctoral degree where I'm trying to take education, especially education with lay people, with like local decision makers, education, permaculture as a practice, and community planning, and weave them together. So over the next couple of years, I'm doing a series of case studies of communities that have really kind of set the course in a very positive way to better understand what they did. You know, because I think you and I today have talked about you can start off with one initiative to change one element. How do you make it more holistic? You know, is there a role for a change agent in that community? Is there just a greater educational awareness? So I want to better understand who those leaders are in North America. You know, we hear about a lot of positive community initiatives with regulations in the Pacific Northwest and up into Canada. And I want to better understand how they're doing it and what lessons we can take back to other communities.
To then, in turn, provide models for people who want to get involved in this kind of process so that they have a framework to work from?
Yeah, so if we can demystify it, show them different ways forward so that they can have that as information as they craft a way that makes sense in their place.
That sounds like a really good way to get people empowered to make this kind of change within a system that's, well, as we said earlier, frankly, kind of intimidating.
I mean, you could do this as a member of the public at a board meeting, but it's been interesting to sit on a planning board again and just ask simple questions. We had a development proposal in front of us last week, and we were going through the process of allowing them to subdivide the land, and it was not well coordinated with the adjacent landowners. And there was already some problem between landowners, and it was headed to court because of this lack of coordination over roads and shared infrastructure. And so I was able to just ask questions, you know, why do we do this? Why don't we require that they come in with a coordinated plan of how this will phase out over time? And other people on the board just didn't know. There hadn't been a way forward. So it had been very disjointed and it had created problems in the past. And now we've identified it and now we're going to address it. And I didn't say, hey, you should do it this other way. I just asked the question. This seems to be creating a lot of heartache for us and for them. Why are we doing it this way?
Through this process of asking questions, is part of the problem because each parcel of land is seen as independent from those around it?
Absolutely. I think that's a huge part of it, Scott. if we take a landscape approach and look at the whole community, and then we allow individual landowners to make changes without looking outside of their property boundaries, then we get this disjointed patchwork of land use change. I'm most familiar with New Hampshire's enabling statutes, the laws at the state level that allow us to make local regulations. But I think it's well within many of our state enabling legislation to require a little bit more coordinated approach, to have the developer talk about those natural resource systems that may cross the property and how they're going to ensure they stay intact, how they're going to preserve them to continue to function, or even maybe restore them if they've already been impaired. But it's that property by property decision-making process that is disjointed.
This makes me think about one of the common conversations in permaculture and what seems to be a conflict sometime between like a holistic approach and a reductionist approach, that one is kind of looking at the world from the top down and the other one is looking from the bottom up, and that somewhere along the line in the middle things get muddy, and that like talking about science versus indigenous wisdom, one is a facts and figures and numbers kind of approach, and another uses storytelling and myth in order to provide a view of the world. And so many different points along the way, are we unable to meet in the middle for some reason? Yet it seems like it should be the most natural thing in the world to be able to look at each individual parcel as part of this bigger picture. But somewhere along the line, that stops happening.
I think that's an excellent point. And I think that, you know, there's no one way forward that's going to work in all towns or cities. One of the things we found is some places really like to regulate things and say, you absolutely must do the following, and be very prescriptive what must happen. Other places like to encourage and incentivize. New Hampshire is very much an incentivized state, where we like to suggest people do things and hope that they will do them. Often they don't do them because there's perceived cost or complexity. But when we offer somebody a carrot, we use the carrot analogy instead of the stick, when we offer an incentive like expedited review, a quicker review process, more of the land to use for their chosen purpose, more flexibility in uses, whatever those things might be, we often find that they'll respond. So I think if you had a case where you said, if you look beyond your property boundaries at how the natural systems flow across the property and you can address that, we will give you this, that there's a give and take. You know, you help us as a community meet our goals, and we're going to help you meet your goal of a reasonable review process and permitting process.
It's a lot. It's just so much. Do you have a place where you'd like to go from that last thought as I turn this over?
I guess where I'd like to go with this is that, you know, I think today's conversation, like other folks you've had on the podcast, I just want to raise this as one of the places we need to put some effort in from a permaculture perspective. We can't ignore the local regulatory and planning processes that happen in our towns and communities. If we do ignore them, we miss a huge opportunity. It's definitely different work for a lot of us, and there is complexity, as you point out, Scott. So we're not going to solve it overnight. But I would just like to engage with others in the permaculture community that are interested in this type of work. I would like to, you know, collaborate with other people. I'd like to learn from what they do and share ideas. And I just think it's exciting to find this other edge, this other permaculture edge, which is the, you know, the local planning and regulatory process. And I will probably work in this area for the rest of my professional life and maybe my, you know, existence on this planet. And I just hope that we continue to see positive change. I don't know if we'll ever fully resolve the problems, but it's a life work here for all of us.
What you just said there reminds me of another piece of the conversation that I have within the permaculture community of reform versus revolution, working within the system versus working outside of it, and that positive versus negative piece. Well, really, I should say it, the negative versus positive engagement piece. If we ignore it, then we can bring a great burden upon ourselves on trying to show a difference and then just get pushed to the edge as someone who shouldn't be listened to. I remember an urban permaculture project someone was sharing information about a guy who was getting fined something like $2,000 a day because of the way that his property looked, because it violated local ordinances, and how that not only impacts that individual because of the financial toll that that can place on them by trying to work outside the system, but also then the way that that changes the social capital that can be built up within the permaculture community by engaging within the system, by working on those things that we can be a part of. as you say, by working on changing those regulations in a positive way to encourage the things that we want rather than trying to discourage the things that we don't want.
I'm glad you made that distinction. And we have lots of examples, you know, from Quebec and now from Los Angeles of people who, you know, had to use a lot of their energy to get people fired up online and in other ways to help understand that they weren't being allowed to grow food, whether it be, you know, Ron Finley in Los Angeles trying to grow it along the side of the road or the folks in Quebec trying to grow it in their own front yard. A tremendous amount of effort into having done something, getting slapped on the wrist for it, and then trying to highlight that this isn't a good way forward and we need to change. And both resulted in really positive reform. But it'd be nice to have someone in all of our communities working on the inside, as you said, to make those changes happen ahead of time.
Well, thank you, Steve, for where this conversation has gone today. I really appreciate it, even as I was very focused on narrative, more so than process today. So thank you for the space to explore some of these thoughts with you. I really, really appreciate that. But before we bring things to a close, do you have any final thoughts for the listeners?
I think just to learn more about how decisions are made in your community, to do, as you said, to read that plan, to pick up the regulations. Many of these things are now available online in communities. If you have local planning staff and you don't understand the process, you know, reach out to them, whether they be volunteer planning board members or paid staff. They probably would be happy to explain the process to you. So I would just ask people to get engaged, learn how things are happening, ask questions, occasionally attend a meeting and offer some perspective. Your questions and your participation, they'll often really make the boards and those that are involved in the process happy. It's nice to be at a meeting and have other people care that the meeting's happening and that these topics are important. But you also bring a certain amount of solutions to the table that otherwise wouldn't be there.
Thank you for all of the conversation today, Steve, and adding a different perspective on how we can engage with permaculture to make a difference in the world we live in and to create the place that we want to live.
You're welcome, Scott. I really appreciate you providing this venue for these conversations. So this was a lot of fun for me.
And that was Steve Whitman of Resilience Planning and Design, LLC. Find out more about him and his work at resilienceplanning.net. One thing Steve wanted to make sure that I shared with you is that his door is open if you want to get in touch with him to talk about planning and getting involved in the process so that you can begin having a direct effect on the policies that impact your life. So feel free to reach out to him through his website. If there's anything I can do to help you on your path, let me know. Email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, call 717-827-6266, or if you prefer, you can write me a letter. The Permaculture Podcast, P.O. Box 16, Dauphin, Pennsylvania, 17018. You can also leave a comment in the show notes, send a tweet to @permaculturecst, or join in the conversation on Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. If you want to get started in changing policies, there are a few steps I recommend from my own work in doing this. Throughout this next section, I am going to refer to the government body you're working with for any specific region as a municipality. In saying that, it's a placeholder for anything from a town to a city, county, state, province, or even national government. So then, first, contact the municipality you want to work with and ask where you can find copies of the local ordinances. More and more, as part of open records and documentation projects, these are available online, though in some places you may need to request a hard copy. Those are usually fairly reasonable. I think I paid $20 for the most up-to-date version from my township, a fair price given the large page count of this book. I'm not kidding, this thing is almost the size of Mollison's designer's manual. Once you've got that, begin reading through it and get an understanding for what's on record. Check the dates of when certain things were put on the books. That might give you some insight into, as Steve suggested, how and where things changed in your area. Yes, the language can seem rather specific and shrouded in legalese, depending on how things are written, but I've yet to find something that is completely incomprehensible. If you do wind up having questions, feel free to call and ask for assistance in understanding what something means. It's a great way to get to know a code enforcement officer on a first-name basis, and they can be a great ally for beginning to bring about change. Next up, foster a relationship with the administrative assistant for the municipality, if there is one. I've repeatedly found that people in this position are the gatekeepers to power. Having a good relationship with them can get you passed directly to various office holders you're trying to get in touch with, and often they can provide insight into where to go next so that you can Create the biggest change with the smallest amount of effort. Finally, start attending board and planning meetings. Use the principle of observation to understand what's happening, see who the different players are, and look for places where you can add your voice to the discussion. A lot of times I find that asking some pointed questions can be very revealing, and then listen to the response and consider what they say in order to help craft your suggestions. You can then weigh in on areas you have expertise and push the edge toward more holistic design. One of my friends is often asked, "How did you get that done?" or "How did you get that job?" And their response is, "I showed up." Being present makes all the difference in the world. From here, an update on me and where things are. As of the release of this show, I will be graduating from grad school with my Master of Science in Park and Resource Management on Saturday, May 9th. If all my numbers are right, I'm going to complete this 2.5-year journey with a 4.0 overall. It's been a long, hard road, particularly while raising a family and continuing to produce the show, but the results are worth it. I've learned plenty that can be applied to the podcast in particular and to permaculture education in general. There's lots and lots to do, and my next step is to continue my education and pursue a doctoral program. I'm still researching where to go and what exactly to study, but now is the time if I'm ever going to breathe life into the plan and see it spring forth into the world. But doing so brings me to another crossroads, though not quite like the crossroads from last year. I know I'm on the right road for myself, but I am in a place where I need to find somewhere to live and an occupation that can help me take care of my children. As much as I want the podcast to be my sole pursuit, it isn't enough at the moment to do so. It is financially self-sufficient at this point and paying for itself, but I am in the process of looking for a full-time job to keep myself going while I keep the show and everything else in the air. Regardless of what happens, the website, the podcast, all of that is going to stay out there and available. But there will be some changes coming in the future. But once things start to settle out, I'll let you know more as I become aware of it. In the meantime, help me keep going by using the PayPal link on the front page of the show at thepermaculturepodcast.com to make a one-time direct contribution. Or you can become a recurring member via Patreon at patreon.com/permaculturepodcast. Beyond that, there are other fun things coming up for the show. June 4th, I'm scheduled to record a roundtable discussion with Charles Eisenstein, Dave Jackie, and Ben Weiss, which will come out shortly thereafter as a two-part or more episode. There's another roundtable recording scheduled for September, where I'll be traveling down to West Virginia to sit down with some permaculture practitioners from the region. And then I'm looking at another road trip to Virginia to do a one-year follow-up with the guests from my last journey, to sit down with Lee and Dave O'Neill of Radical Roots, to check in on Holly Brown at Island Creek, Rick Williams at Lick Run, and I'll hopefully swing over and see how Trish Wright's permaculture garden is going. And as part of that, I'll add some more guests and interviews to that. Plus, some more travel that I have. In August, I'll get to go to Canada and be the best man at a dear friend's wedding. I won't be recording anything there, but it will be some good fun. Whatever the future holds, wherever my path leads, I will remain here as a resource for you, however I am able. You are not alone on your permaculture journey, so contact me, however you would like, if I can help you. Until the next time, take care of Earth, yourself, and each other.